This episode features discussion of abduction, religious extremism, suicide, torture, and violence that some people may find upsetting or offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. It was 1:30 in the morning. In the 4 hours since the Chechen terrorists had taken charge, the Dubrovka House of Culture had grown quiet, but not silent. Despite the late hour, most of the hostages were wide awake.
The doors at the back of the theater flew open, startling everyone. A young woman stood in the door, looking out over the audience seats full of hostages.
Movsar Barayev, the terrorist leader, jumped down from his place on the stage, Kalashnikov rifle swinging on his shoulder. He yelled, "How did you get here?"
The woman responded, "I've been coming here since I was a child. I went to music school here. I know this building."
Barayev forced the woman into a seat near the front of the auditorium. She got back on her feet instantly, pushing Movsar away from her.
She yelled, "Who do you think you are? You should be ashamed of yourselves. Look at how you've terrified everyone."
She then turned to the audience.
"Is this the time to be scared? Look how many of you there are. Why are you sitting here like sheep? You have to do something."
The theater full of Russian civilians was silent. After blinking away his disbelief at this woman's audacity, Movsar Barayev turned to the gunmen lining the aisles. "Execute her."
The hostages begged Movsar to spare this woman's life, telling them she was drunk and didn't know what she was saying.
The unknown woman held her head high and continued to call the terrorist cowards as they dragged her into the lobby.
A moment later, they silenced her permanently.
This is Hostage, the new Parcast podcast telling the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive. I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy. You can listen to all of Parcast's podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen.
This is our second episode on the Moscow Theater hostage crisis.
On October 23rd, 2002, a group of 40 to 50 armed Chechen militants, calling themselves part of the Special Purposes Islamic Regiment, or SPIR, S-P-I-R, captured a theater in Moscow. They imprisoned the audience, staff, and cast members as leverage to persuade the Russian government to withdraw forces from Chechnya. Last week, we discussed the ongoing conflicts between Russia and Chechnya and the events that led up to the attack on the theater.
This week, in part two, we'll go step by step through the 3-day standoff. We'll cover how the hostages coped with their new circumstances and how the Russian government reacted to SPIR leader Movsar Barayev's demands, ending with the deadly rescue conducted by the Russian Spetsnaz.
The night of October 23rd, 2002, news of the Dubrovka theater hostages spread like wildfire. The hostages had been allowed to use cell phones to call their loved ones, who were reasonably distressed. Some of the non-Russian citizens took time to call their embassies in an attempt to expedite their own release. The demands of the hostage takers, that the hostages would be freed when Russian troops left Chechnya, spread too. An hour after the hostages were taken, police and armed forces surrounded the Dubrovka House of Culture. They were joined by families and friends of the captives.
At 11 p.m., Russian President Vladimir Putin made a public statement, sitting at the table, flanked by Federal Security Service head Nikolai Patrushev and Interior Minister Boris Gryzlov.
In this statement, he asserted his belief that the Chechen terrorists of SPIR were part of an international terrorist conspiracy. implying a link to Al-Qaeda and the war in the Middle East.
So far, there had been no proof that the Special Purpose Islamic Regiment had anything to do with Al-Qaeda outside of their shared faith. It seems Putin's goal here was to garner sympathy from Western powers, since a terror attack in a seemingly unassailable metropolis was fresh in their minds after 9/11.
President Putin closed his statement with these words, which translate from Russian as, quote, "The main goal of our law enforcement agencies and special services should be directed at freeing the captives with the maximum guarantee of their safety," end quote.
Unbeknownst to the terrorist, Putin had completely cleared his calendar to focus on the hostage crisis. He postponed a meeting with the German chancellor in Berlin and canceled his weekend trip to an APEC forum in Mexico with U.S. President George W. Bush.
He could not risk another disaster like the Budenovsk hostage crisis, which we mentioned last week.
As a refresher, over 100 people died and over 400 were injured when a Chechen militant group took control of a Russian hospital in 1995. The move was intended to end the Russian-Chechen war and did lead to peace talks between the two countries.
7 years later, Russia and Chechnya were at war again. President Putin and the Russian government realized that these terrorists, if not directly working with the Budenovsk hostage takers, were likely copying their tactics.
But if they modeled their tactics off of Budenovsk, Spur made a critical error. While Putin's predecessor, Boris Yeltsin, was a corrupt bureaucrat who caved easily to terrorist demands, Putin himself was an ex-KGB strongman who firmly believed in Russian dominance over Chechnya. He was not willing to withdraw troops, and he was not willing to negotiate.
In only a few short hours, the Dubrovka House of Culture had completely transformed. Gone were the glittering lights and peppy music. Spur members had hung an enormous black banner with Arabic letters over the stage.
One of the hostages asked what it meant. A terrorist translated for them, saying, quote, "There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet," end quote.
On the now desolate stage, Mavsar Barayev, Abu Bakr, and the other terrorist leaders plotted behind the sliding panels that Nordost used instead of a curtain.
In the audience, the hostages were in two groups, Russians and non-Russians. There were just under 100 non-Russians in the theater, including Bulgarian businessman Veselin Nedkov. Nedkov was waiting in the back of the theater, clutching his passport. Mavsar Barayev had promised to release any foreigners in the audience, but so far had yet to act on this promise.
That first night, beneath the feet of the terrorists and their hostages, a pipe burst and began to flood the basement level of the building.
Annoyed, the terrorists did not bother to secure the basement. This left an opening for someone to get in. But for now, they were concerned about people getting out.
The hostages were not allowed to leave the auditorium, even to use the restroom. The recently vacated orchestra pit became a latrine. Although the House of Culture had a state-of-the-art ventilation system, it did not take long before the auditorium reeked of human waste.
The male terrorists, armed with AK-47s, patrolled the corridors and stood by the entryways, making sure no one would attempt an escape. Many of the female terrorists, however, sat among the hostages. Not that it made them any less threatening. Each one of the so-called Black Widows wore a suicide vest and carried a grenade, ready to destroy the theater at a moment's notice.
5-year-old Varvara Kornilova was the only person who was completely unafraid to speak to the terrorists, unlike her petrified mother and older sister. She chatted with the female members of Spur near her seat in the balcony. Varvara was too young to understand the severity of the situation, and it didn't help when the terrorists gave her candy from the theater's concession stand.
A few hours into the siege, Spur members distributed soft drinks and snacks taken from the concession stand. Some of these soft drinks were in glass bottles, which could be used as weapons. However, no one was thinking about that at this point. everyone was hoping to get out of the situation peacefully, including Movsar Barayev.
Below the Kornilova family's balcony seats, Nordos producer and co-writer Georgi Vasilev played host to Movsar Barayev and the Chechen militants, showing them around the theater and attempting to keep tensions as low as possible.
During a conversation with Vasilev, Barayev thought he heard boots on the roof. He commanded his men to rake the ceiling with machine gun fire.
Vasilev panicked at this, insisting that the ceiling had been specially designed for his production and would collapse if fired on. Barayev conceded, and SPUR members did not shoot at the ceiling again.
In the first few hours of the siege, hostages were allowed to speak to family and friends on their cell phones for brief periods. On the night of October 23rd, these calls were the only communication from the theater to the outside world. The terrorists let their demands spread by word of mouth, terror flying like a rumor.
Meanwhile, the Russian Special Forces, aka Spetsnaz, monitored these phone calls and set up snipers on nearby apartment buildings, preparing to strike. The operation was given the code name Thunderstorm.
Operation Thunderstorm was the responsibility of Alpha Squad, the elite anti-terrorist Spetsnaz unit, the same unit which witnessed a horrifying loss of life in the recent Budenovsk hospital hostage crisis. This was their chance for redemption.
None of the Chechens or hostages were visible from outside the theater, meaning Alpha Squad could not accurately assess the risks of storming the building. All they had to go on were the cell phone conversations from inside the building.
As they monitored the cell phone signals, the security team was able to ascertain phone numbers and call into the theater, requesting to talk to the terrorist. The members of SPUR refused.
As of midnight on October 23rd, 2002, SPUR had not killed anyone in their capture of the Dubrovka Theater. The hostages were scared, sleep-deprived, and hungry, but all were alive.
Until 1:30 a.m. on October 24th.
A mysterious woman snuck into the theater. She was not one of the initial hostages, and she seemed slightly drunk. She immediately confronted Movsar Barayev.
When she challenged him, Barayev had her dragged out into the lobby and shot. He loudly proclaimed, quote, "She was from the Spetsnaz. They did the same thing in Budenovsk. They sent someone into the hospital, pretending to be drunk. But he was a spy, sending information to the forces outside. So we shot him, like we shot her," end quote.
The woman was not a spy. Her name was Olga Romanova, and she worked at a nearby boutique selling French perfume. A 26-year-old aspiring actress and musician, she had taken music lessons at the House of Culture and knew the building inside and out. Romanova had been working late, and when she heard about the attack on the news, she was outraged.
No one knows how she slipped past the police barricade, and no one outside saw her enter the theater. Spetsnaz wasn't aware anything had happened until they heard the gunshot.
Their immediate conclusion was that the Chechens had started executing hostages. They were running out of time.
Up next, we'll see how the hostages handled their first morning in the theater. Now, back to the story.
Inside the Dubrovka House of Culture, Movsar Barayev was growing impatient. It was early in the morning of October 24th, and he'd been up since SPUR took control of the theater the night before. He was frustrated by the lack of cooperation from the Russian government. Russian forces remained in Chechnya.
Around this time, one of Barayev's comrades picked up a camcorder, recording the hostages and SPUR members on blurry standard definition video.
On the video, a woman attempted to bargain with Movsar for her husband's release. She claimed he had a weak heart due to a recent surgery, and she worried the stress might kill him. Movsar refused to make any exceptions, and when she wouldn't back down, he brandished a pistol in her face. For several interminable moments, she did not move, but he did not shoot.
Another man from the audience stood up and led the woman back to her seat, leaving Movsar frozen in place, pistol still raised.
This moment, like many others, seemed to indicate that young Movsar was not suited to leadership. Aside from the clear demands he issued to the Russian government, he seemed indecisive and nervous, like he was not prepared for the stress of such a prolonged siege.
At around 5 a.m. on Thursday the 24th, Movsar called to the non-Russian portion of the audience, telling them to get their passports ready.
8 hours into the siege, Movsar Buraev let everyone know he would release over a dozen children under the age of 12 as a gesture of good faith.
The news spread quickly. Prominent Russian singer Iosif Kobzon volunteered to escort the children out of the theater. The Russian government agreed, since he was a non-threatening public figure who the children would know on their release.
When he arrived in the theater, Kobzon witnessed Varvara Kornilova, the chatty five-year-old, and her sisters get torn away from their mother, Lyubov. Incensed, Kobzon confronted terrorist Abu Bakr about this.
Kobzon asked Abu Bakr, quote, "Why do you need a mother without kids? Why would I take these kids without their mom?" End quote.
After a moment of consideration, Abu Bakr allowed Lyubov Kornilova to leave with her daughters. It was a small concession to make to keep things flowing smoothly.
Others were not so lucky. Svetlana Gubareva pleaded with the terrorists to let her daughter Sasha go, but since Sasha was 13, they refused her outright.
After several failed attempts to get her daughter out, Svetlana broke down crying. For all she knew, her daughter would never again see the outside of the theater.
The Russians made their own efforts to escape the situation. A student in the balcony attempted to persuade a suicide bomber that the more authentic Muslim act was to abandon her bomb and not seek personal revenge. He asked her if she thought she was doing the right thing.
This was a clever tactic, one former FBI hostage negotiator Chris Voss describes as cognitive empathy. It's the ability to understand and recognize the hostage taker's motives without judgment or implicit agreement. According to Voss, cognitive empathy is extremely important in diffusing tension in hostage scenarios.
However, the student's efforts were cut short by the interruption of another terrorist. He roughly interrupted, saying, "She's a suicide bomber, a Shahid, and she has come here to die."
A few hours later, around 9 a.m. on Thursday, October 24th, about 60 more hostages, all non-Russians, were released from the building. It was 12 hours into the siege. However, there was still a group of non-Russians in the theater. Bulgarian businessman Veselin Nedkov was still held hostage and saw growing agitation among his fellow non-Russian audience members. Freedom felt tantalizingly close, and yet every second they spent in the theater was a second they risked dying by a terrorist bullet, bomb, or grenade.
Through an intermediary, Spur requested that doctors be sent into the theater to help the weaker and elderly hostages, as long as none of the doctors were Russian.
When the doctors arrived, they had to remove Olga Romanova's body from the lobby before they could help anyone. She'd been lying there for just over 10 hours, her blood congealing on the floor. Russian media incorrectly reported her as the first hostage slain by the Chechens.
So far, no members of the SPUR had spoken directly to Russian officials. A television broadcast the morning of the 24th urged the Chechen terrorist to get in touch with the Russian authorities.
A short time later, the Qatar-based television station Al Jazeera broadcast a tape that they claimed had been dropped off anonymously.
This tape showed Movsar Buraev sitting in front of a laptop. He proclaimed, quote, "We've come to Russia's capital city to stop the war or die for Allah," end quote. After several shots of the Black Widows, it cuts back to Movsar, who repeats their slogan, "We desire death more than they desire life."
Whatever the intent of this tape, it seemed to prove that Putin's statement the night before was correct. These were not merely Chechen nationalists, but radical Islamic terrorists.
The likelihood that these terrorists would be seen as freedom fighters was now incredibly slim. As far as worldwide viewers were concerned, this was another wing in the war on terror, an attempt at a second 9/11.
Late evening on Thursday, October 24th, British journalist Mark Franchetti managed to talk his way into joining the Red Cross doctors as they delivered aid to the hostages. There, he got a hold of Movsar Buraev's cell number. A few hours later, he managed to convince Movsar to grant him an interview.
It was growing more and more apparent that the spur under Buraev hadn't thought through the fine details when planning their hostage taking. Unprepared for Putin's stonewalling, perhaps they thought an appearance on public television would garner sympathy for their cause and force his hand.
Finally consenting to direct contact, Movsar insisted that Franchetti bring a camera and come alone. Franchetti approached the theater with his hands over his head, wary the Chechens would mistake him for another intruder and shoot him as they had Olga Romanova.
When Franchetti sat down with Buraev, Buraev seemed unbelievably cocky. He said, quote, "The Russian authorities call us terrorists, but if we were terrorists, we'd have asked for a plane and $1 million, end quote.
Franchetti asked how things were going. One of Movsar's masked associates replied, quote, "Excellent. Never better. This is a dream come true." They then repeated, "We desire death more than the victims desire life," end quote.
Movsar spoke to another pair of journalists after Franchetti. They were from NTV, a privately run Russian news station. Once in the room with them, he made a deal.
Buraev promised to release 12 more hostages if they recorded and publicly broadcast a statement from the terrorists.
At about 5 a.m. on Friday, the 25th, NTV broadcast Movsar Buraev's statement. Due to pressure from the Russian government, they played the interview without audio. Representatives of the government insisted that the audio portion of the interview violated Russia's law against broadcasting extremist propaganda.
This did not go over well with the terrorists, who believed this was a direct violation of the agreement they had with NTV.
Movsar was getting more and more agitated, frequently taking the stage to announce to the hostages how their government didn't care about them.
By this point, just over 24 hours into the siege, Putin was under immense pressure to open talks. Around 200 Russian civilians, families and friends of the hostages mostly, had drafted a letter urging Putin to negotiate with the Chechens. Putin refused to read it. He insisted he would get everyone out safe and alive without recalling the troops from Chechnya.
Despite the increasing frustration of their captors, none of the hostages had been killed. The only casualty so far was Olga Romanova, the woman who snuck into the theater and confronted Buraev. And though they threatened them with bombs and AK-47s, SPUR members weren't overtly cruel to their hostages.
Hostages described the Black Widow suicide bombers as remarkably courteous and even friendly in some instances. Among them was Zura Buraeva, the widow of Chechen warlord Arbi Buraev, Movsar's uncle.
Vladimir Nedkov's fiancée, Irina Filipova, recalled Zura's behavior during the event as, quote, "very normal. She hid her feelings behind a mask of courtesy. She seemed to take pleasure that she was in this situation, that people were listening to her and wanting to talk to her, that she was in control. She would ask people if they had children. She would always say, everything will be fine. It will finish peacefully. She took off her bomb belt and carried it over her shoulder, all very relaxed," end quote.
While held hostage, producer Georgi Vasilev sat down next to the woman guarding the massive bomb in the center of the theater. Ever the faithful host, he figured that he might be able to grab the detonator and disarm her if necessary. She recognized him when they sat down and struck up a conversation about Nordost.
A fan of theater and music, she seemed thrilled to chat with a successful musician and producer. She even admitted that she enjoyed what she had seen of Nordost, despite its heavily pro-Russian message.
After some conversation, she handed him a piece of paper with Arabic words written on it. She said, quote, "If you repeat these words when you are about to die, you will go to heaven," end quote.
The words were La ilaha illallah, which mean there is no God but Allah.
In their cell phone conversations, the hostages were remarkably forgiving of their captors. A student, Svetlana Razgon, told her father, quote, "Daddy, don't worry, they don't beat us," end quote.
At this point, Russian television stations began to widely speculate about the effects of Stockholm Syndrome on the hostages.
According to the FBI Law Enforcement Bulletin in 1999, which was the most up-to-date information at the time, the three circumstantial factors required for Stockholm Syndrome were the passage of time, continual contact, and small acts of kindness without direct and persistent abuse.
At first glance, the Moscow theater crisis does fit these criteria. However, one of the key components in Stockholm Syndrome is a refusal by hostages to cooperate with outside forces' attempts at rescue. Not only did the hostages regularly demonstrate a desire for freedom, the only time they spoke against the authorities was in fear for their own lives and safety.
On the afternoon of Friday the 25th, Vesely Nedkov, who had been waiting in the foreigners section of the theater, received more horrible news. The promise to release all foreign hostages was off, and the Russian government declared they were no longer recognizing any distinction between Russian and non-Russian hostages.
Perhaps Putin believed that any concession at all would show the public that their government was willing to play by the terrorist rules.
Outside the theater, protesters were gathering just beyond the police outpost.
One of their banners memorably read, "What would you do, Mr. Putin, if your daughter were inside?" Others protested the war or contained messages of encouragement for their imprisoned compatriots.
Everyone wanted action from the Russian government. At 5 p.m. on Friday, Movsar Baraev issued an ultimatum. If Russia did not begin withdrawal of its forces from Chechnya by 7 p.m. that night, they would start killing hostages.
Even if Putin wanted to cooperate, there was no way they could make any progress in only 2 hours. But they had to keep Baraev from pulling the trigger.
Just before 7 p.m., the terrorists received a call from the last person they expected. General Kazantsev, the Russian commander in the Caucasus region, offered to come to the theater at 10 o'clock the next morning. He would only do this if none of the hostages were harmed.
You can imagine the skepticism and shock in the theater. This man had been leading Russian troops against Chechens for most of his career, and now he was offering to meet with them? This was incredibly unlikely.
And yet, desperate to have some form of progress achieved, Movsar Baraev took this offer under consideration. A conversation with a high-ranking Russian official was an extremely tempting prospect, and a possible sign that Russia was willing to negotiate.
As a result, no one was killed at 7 p.m.
The killing didn't start until midnight.
In the middle of the night, the hostages heard gunfire outside the theater. They all tensed up, and some that had been dozing were instantly awake. Was this the moment? Was Alpha Squad making their move?
A moment later, two gunmen dragged a man in civilian clothes into the theater. He was about 40 years old and his face was covered in blood. He held a plastic shopping bag in his hands.
The terrorists dragged him onto the stage, where they threw him at Baraev's feet.
Movsar demanded to know his name and what he was doing there. He introduced himself as Yanadi Vlach. He had run across Red Square after dusk and slipped into the theater, just like Olga Romanova had done 2 days earlier.
As Baraev questioned the man on stage, the hostages looked on, as if they were watching a continuation of Nordost.
Vlach claimed to be looking for his son, Roman, who had been missing for 2 days. Baraev turned to the audience and called out, "Is anyone called Roman here?"
There was no response. After asking a few more times, Mavsar began beating the man. He was joined by the other Chechens, who hurled insults at him as they did so, calling him a goat, which is a Chechen insult reserved for Russian soldiers.
Mavsar unshouldered his Kalashnikov rifle and pointed it at the man.
Once again, the audience began pleading for Mavsar not to shoot. Mavsar responded to the terrified audience, quote, "All right then, we'll shoot him outside," end quote.
The Chechens pushed Yanadi Vlach to his feet and dragged him off the stage. Mavsar and a handful of gunmen followed them out into the lobby, where they had executed Olga Romanova.
A commotion rang out at the back of the theater. Denis Grybkov, a 30-year-old man, had been waiting for the perfect moment to act. When he saw Baryev leave the auditorium, he made his move.
Grybkov removed a glass soda bottle from beneath his chair and charged one of the Black Widows, who was sitting next to one of the larger explosives.
One of the gunmen saw his movement and opened fire. His shots went wide and struck two other audience members. Tamara Starkova was hit in the abdomen and severely injured. However, she was luckier than Pavel Zakharov. A bullet passed straight through his eye, knocking him unconscious.
Before he could reach his target, Grybkov was seized by the terrorists and dragged up onto the stage, where the Chechens beat him mercilessly.
Outside, the terrorists shot Yanadi Vlach.
Mavsar re-entered the theater and commanded them to execute Grybkov as well. For the third time, they escorted a civilian into the lobby and fired.
House manager Marina Krylova rushed forward to help the injured hostages. A former nurse, Marina demanded they call doctors as soon as possible. Both Starkova and Zakharov were in critical condition.
According to Nedkov's account, Mavsar was almost panicking at this point. He seemed anxious to assure the Russian government that they had not started executing hostages yet. He had a woman call emergency services and explain the situation.
Spur's tenuous control of the situation was slipping.
During the chaos, Russian Spetsnaz smuggled a top-secret weapon into the flooded basement. Once it was in place, they would be ready to assault the theater. Now back to the story.
Early in the morning of Friday, October 25th, employees of the Meridian House of Culture were given the day off with no explanation. But those who were savvy may have realized it had something to do with the fact that the Meridian House of Culture building was nearly identical to the Dubrovka House of Culture building.
The audience of Nordost had been held hostage for nearly 36 hours, and the Russian government had plans to rescue them by force.
Once the Meridian House of Culture was empty, a column of military vehicles rolled up. An Alpha squad occupied the building.
With the same design but several kilometers south, the Meridian House of Culture was the ideal location for Alpha squad to run drills and refine their assault strategy. They familiarized themselves with every corner of the auditorium and surrounding hallways so they would not be surprised by the terrorists.
In a way, it was almost like a dress rehearsal for the assault.
But Alpha Squad's plan required more than a day of practice in an identical building. In order for the assault to be successful, they needed to make sure the hostages weren't killed in the crossfire.
After spending much of Friday, October 25th, drilling, they prepared a secondary weapon, a chemical intended to incapacitate everyone in the theater without killing them.
That night, while Baryev was distracted by Yanadi Vlach's sudden appearance, Spetsnaz troops smuggled this aerosol weapon into the theater.
Shortly after, Red Cross representatives returned to the theater to remove the two injured hostages. By then, Pavel Zakharov had succumbed to his head wound and died in the theater. The death toll was now 4. Olga Romanova, Yanadi Vlach, Denis Grybkov, and Pavel Zakharov.
The Russian government still had no intention of cooperating with terrorists. The impending parley with Kazantsev was a bluff, intended to lure the Chechens into a false sense of security. Given the volatile nature of the Spur leadership, This was a risky move.
However, it paid off. In the early hours of Saturday morning, October 26th, Movsar grabbed Nord-Ost producer Georgi Vasilev and escorted him to the control room above the balcony. There, he demanded Vasilev play back the footage of Spur interrupting the musical.
Believing negotiations were imminent, Baryev was willing to let his guard down and savor their victory. It had been a grueling 48 hours, but it seemed like their demands might finally be answered. Chechnya might finally be free from Russian rule.
But a few hours later, at 5 a.m. Saturday morning, Operation Thunderstorm went into action.
Inside the theater, the hostages heard a low hissing sound from the ventilation system. A strong smell seeped into the auditorium, strong enough to overpower even the rancid stench from the orchestra pit.
Hostage Anya Andrianova looked up to see a strange vapor descending onto the seats.
As they realized what was happening, panic seized the hostages and terrorists alike. One of Andrianova's friends, who still had her cell phone, called into a morning radio show, Echo Moskvy, or Echo of Moscow.
When the hosts answered, she screamed in panic, "They are gassing us!"
Andrianova took the phone and explained, "We see it. We feel it. We are breathing through our clothes."
A moment later, Echo Moskvy's listeners heard gunfire. Andrianova exclaimed, quote, "That's it. We're all going to be blown up. Our government has decided no one should leave here alive," end quote.
The signal cut out.
Chaos seized the theater. Terrorists and hostages were falling unconsciously left and right. Instead of detonating their suicide vests, several of the Black Widows made a break for the balcony. They all collapsed before they reached the stairs.
Some of the gunmen fit respirators on over their masks and prepared themselves for the impending assault.
There was only so much they could do, however, as the strike came almost immediately.
When the shooting stopped, all the terrorists were dead. The ones who were knocked unconscious by the gas were shot where they slept.
Russian TV showed Movsar Baryev lying on the floor amongst broken glass, a bottle of cognac near his hand, somehow still intact. Was he having a drink to celebrate when the gassing started? Or did Russian media outlets plant it to make the terrorists seem like incompetent drunks? We'll probably never know.
None of the bombs had gone off. Some members of Alpha Squad fell unconscious when their gas mask failed, but not a single Russian soldier was killed in the shootout. After 56 hours, the hostages were finally safe from the terrorists.
But the chaos in the theater during the gunfight was nothing compared to the chaos immediately following the incident. Ambulances were on standby to evacuate the hostages, but they ran into a snag.
The chemical used to incapacitate the terrorists remains classified, but later Russian officials said it was based on the opiate fentanyl. Doctors were not made aware during the crisis and had no idea what drugs they should use in order to treat side effects.
In transit to nearby hospitals, many unconscious hostages were transported on their backs. When left in such a position, a number of them suffered from tongue prolapse, where the tongue falls back into the throat and blocks the airway.
According to court testimony from Professor Vorobyov, director of the Russian Academic Bacteriology Center, most of the deaths from the hostage crisis were caused by suffocation.
Audience member Svetlana Gubareva was separated from both her daughter Sasha and her American fiancé, Sandy Booker. Sasha died on the way to the hospital. Sandy was already dead from asphyxiation by the time they took his body from the theater.
The two 13-year-old actors, Arseny Kurilenko and Kristina Kurbatova, were among the dead. Eight musicians in the Nord-Ost Orchestra had also died.
All told, 130 hostages died during the rescue. Some survivors claim the number is much higher, and the Russian government wished to downplay the number of fatalities they were directly responsible for.
Vladimir Putin defended the actions of Alpha Squad as necessary for saving the vast majority of hostages. He declared the following Monday a national day of mourning for the deceased.
As far as we know, all the terrorists were killed in the attack.
Despite the death toll among Russian citizens, the Moscow theater hostage crisis had a much worse impact on Chechnya. Chechen President Aslan Maskhadov denied any knowledge of this event and condemned both the attack itself and the ruthless solution employed by Putin's government.
His ignorance of the plan was reinforced by a concurrent statement by Shamil Basayev, engineer of the Budenovsk hospital siege. Basayev publicly claimed responsibility for planning the incident and apologized to Maskhadov for not informing him. However, with Movsar Barayev and all known members of SPUR dead, we can't confirm whether Basayev was involved at all.
Basayev justified the attack, saying it gave, quote, all Russians a firsthand insight into all the charms of the war unleashed by Russia, end quote, and insisted, the next time, those who come won't make any demands and they won't take hostages.
This statement was followed by suicide bombings of Russian civilian targets in both 2003 and 2004.
In the aftermath of the theater incident, anti-Chechen sentiment among Russian civilians grew. People of Chechen descent living in Russia are still frequently subject to abuse from Russian nationalist groups.
According to former Federal Security Service officer Alexander Litvinenko, two of the Chechen militants were working for the Federal Security Service, or FSB. These included the man known as Abu Bakr. According to some versions of the story, Abu Bakr was the real man in charge and escaped the theater with his life after the siege. These claims remain unsubstantiated by any official investigation.
In an attempt to move on from the crisis, Moscow Mayor Yuri Luzhkov financed a revival of Nordost less than a year later. Georgi Vasilev was doubtful it would be a success in light of the tragedy surrounding the play, but could not refuse the offer. The production was remounted on February 8, 2003.
It was a financial failure. Despite great public support, Vasilev was right. The play was now inextricably linked to a horrifying event. It closed in May of 2003.
The Second Chechen War ended in 2009, after 9 years, 7 months, and 3 weeks. Since then, sporadic insurgency in Chechnya and the North Caucasus region continues to this day. Chechnya's separatist government is no more. With the new authoritarian regime under Ramzan Kadyrov expressing complete devotion to Vladimir Putin.
The notorious terrorist organization ISIL now takes credit for many suicide bombings and shootings that happen in and around Chechnya. And as Shamil Basayev said, they are no longer making demands or taking hostages.
Any noble intentions of an independent Chechnya are now just a memory. You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory. And if you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen.
We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Michael Langsner, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Robert Teamstra and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.